There was a group of psychologists who gathered some kids between the ages of 4 and 8 together, and they asked these kids to define the word love. One of the young ladies by the name of Noelle, who was age 7 at the time, stated, "Love is when you tell a boy you like his shirt and he wears it every day for a week afterwards." Carl, who was age 5, a little more dramatic, said, "Love is when a girl puts on perfume and a boy puts on shaving cologne and they go out and smell each other." I guess Billy, who is age 4, though, was the more insightful of the group. And Billy said, "When someone loves you, the way they say your name is different. You know that your name is safe in their mouth." And I like that definition. I think what these kids show us is really something that most adults find difficult, and that's coming up with a definition for the word love. We think about the culture in which we live, and if we were to ask people to define love, we would find all kinds of different responses and all kinds of different answers. And sadly, many times we allow societal definitions to kind of become our definitions. And so what we get is this rather nebulous idea that throws in good feelings and it throws in warm feelings and it throws in romantic love until we've got some kind of definition that really makes not a lot of sense. What's fortunate for us is that the Bible clearly defines love, tells us exactly what love is. In fact, from the passage that Scott read for us this morning, God says, "You want to know the definition of love? Here it is." And he spends pretty much a chapter defining that for us. But what I would like for us to do this morning is to look at the definition from Romans chapter 12. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been working our way through Romans 12, and we've talked about not being conformed to this world, being transformed to the ways of God. Last week, we talked about the idea that we are to get rid of all pride, dismiss all pride, to treat each other the way we wish to be treated. And as we continue on down in the chapter this morning, as one person said, the walkology of chapter 12, we come down to verses 9 and 10, and here is something that God says to lights in the world about love. And so he says in verse 9, "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Let love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor." It's interesting that as we think about being lights in the world, just how important it is for us to have the concept of love down pat as God describes it. And in these two short verses that we find here in Romans chapter 12, what we find is God saying, if you are a Christian, if you are a follower of mine, this is how you love. And he even goes further to say, as we'll see in the lesson this morning, this is who you love. And so I'd like for us to talk about that. This idea of fuel for those who are going to be lights in the world, what God has said concerning the love that we are to show. As we begin there in verse 9, the Lord gives us a very broad picture of the concept of love. And what he basically says is my expectation for you is that you have love for your fellow man. You have love for everyone. What's not so readily evident in English translations of the Bible is exactly what God is saying as the magnitude of that love. What he's doing here is commanding the highest form of selfless love one can possibly give. If we were to look in the Greek translation, it would be the word agape, which we're familiar with. The idea of self-sacrificing, the idea that we put all of our wants and desires away and we concentrate fully on someone else. That's a rather challenging idea, because it is the same kind of love that God describes in what He did for us. When He says in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world." For God so agape the world, had this selfless desire that He gave His only begotten Son. And so as the apostle begins this discussion on love, what he's saying is let me make sure you understand exactly how serious this idea is that I'm talking about. It's the God standard love. And so as we consider that, we understand that God is saying, and for my people, for those who are going to be lights in the world, this is the kind of love you are to show. Albert Barnes described it as goodwill toward mankind. W.E. Vine stated that Christian love, whether exercised toward the brethren or toward men generally, is not an impulse from the feelings. It does not always run with the natural inclinations, nor does it spend itself upon those from whom some affinity is discovered. Love seeks the welfare of all and works no ill to any. We start thinking about that concept and we realize the seriousness of what we're talking about this morning. And so as the apostle says, if you are going to be a light in the world, if you are going to be a transformed Christian, this is what you are to be showing to everyone. This is to be the kind of love that emulates the love that God had for us in the actions that we have toward others. Consider a couple of ideas where this is brought out. Again, here in the book of Romans, chapter 15 and verse 2, the apostle says, let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. There's part of the definition. The idea that we are doing something for someone else's well-being. We continue on and we see another occasion in Romans chapter 13 where the apostle says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And so we take these ideas and we understand the selfless nature of them, as we'll be examining several times this morning. And we understand that God is saying that the kind of love that I'm describing to you is the kind of love where you are seeking the opportunity to do good for others. And I want us to pay attention to that. It's not showing love when the situation presents itself to us. It's the idea that we are on the hunt, that we are looking for the opportunity to display this kind of affection in our walk as lights in the world. Listen to what Paul told the Galatians in chapter 6 and verse 10. He says, so then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. Now, Paul doesn't stop there. While he identifies that we are to love, he goes on and he adds a clause to that. He says this love that you are to illustrate to others must be a genuine love. And I think it's so intriguing that the apostle adds this, because what he's saying in it is there can be no hypocrisy involved. You can't have some kind of hypocritical ambition where on the surface it appears that you're showing this concern and this care and this love for someone, but really deep down, this is for your own selfish desires. Let me illustrate that with a proverb. When we go over to the book of Proverbs to chapter 26, here is what Solomon tells us about that kind of hypocritical love, that kind of hypocrisy being shown. He says, like the glaze covering an earthen vessel are fervent lips with an evil heart. Whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors deceit in his heart. When he speaks graciously, believe him not. For there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred be covered with deception, his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly. And I pick out this particular passage for this reason. Because in thinking about it, I want us to think about the word sincere. When we look at the origins of the word sincere, it means literally without wax. Because what would happen in ancient times, if you were selling pottery and one of your pots developed a crack in it and you were unscrupulous, what you would do is you would cover it with wax. You would cover it with this glaze. so that when someone looked at it, it would look perfectly good. It would look perfectly fine, and the transaction would be completed. But when the buyer got it home and put something in it, the pot would break apart. And so those merchants who wanted to make sure that their customers could believe them would write sincero on the pot without wax. And so what Solomon is saying is, if we are the kind of people who are loving hypocritically, we're like the insincere vessel. We're like the vessel coated in wax that's trying to hide something. What the apostle tells us is this, that if we are going to be sincere, then we must be, spiritually speaking, without wax, without deception. And so this genuine love is shown, and it's illustrated to others in the actions that we are carrying out for them. And we understand that behind every one of those actions, it's manifested in love. We consider as well what John tells us in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 18, when he says, "Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." That's the action. That's where the love is being shown. That's where the love is being seen for our fellow man. And as we have noted, they must be for completely unselfish reasons. I want to look at the negative side of that. As we think about the people of Jesus' day, as he described the Pharisees and those who were so given to this hypocritical kind of love, he described them this way: "Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward." The reason they were doing good is so that they could get the praise of men. There was a hypocrisy. There was something within them that they desired, not for the betterment of their fellow man, but for that which would benefit themselves. So what do we find thus far? Paul says, show selfless love to mankind, to the world around you. Be genuine, no hypocrisy involved. But yet he still takes it one step further. He then says, when you consider this love, you've got to make sure that you understand the difference between what is sincere and what is insincere. And he goes on to describe that in the latter part of verse 9. And he says, when you think about this love, you need to understand that the motivation, in fact, the kind of person you are, is one who abhors anything that's evil. That word abhor means to shudder from, or to have a horror of. In other words, when I am developing myself into a light of the world and I'm going to display this love to my fellow man, I understand that within my thoughts and my motives and my actions, there can be nothing remotely associated with wickedness. Jim McGuigan tells us that it's divine disgust. Now, I like that concept. The idea that we completely hate any and everything that's motivated by wickedness. Let's look at a passage that puts these two concepts together. Familiar one to us as we look at 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. "Do not love the world, nor the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Here in Romans chapter 12, the apostle is saying, love those people in the world with a kind of love that's going to help them. John tells us, have no love for the world in the sense of all of this wickedness that surrounds a culture, that surrounds the time in which we live. That abhorrence to evil in context in Romans chapter 12 means that we shun any type of unkindness. We shun any type of malice toward others. And the apostle goes on to say, and when you abhor that which is evil, in showing the genuineness of your love, you cling, you hold fast to that which is good. Again, we're looking at a lot of word origins today, but this particular word for holding fast or clinging is actually the idea of being glued to. adhering. I think a very good example of that, and some of you ladies have experienced this, I know, many times over. You're teaching a group of young kids, and maybe it's the first time that a child is going to class. And what does that child do? He grabs his mama as tightly as he can with his legs and his arms, and he's hanging on, and you're trying to pry that child off. No, he's holding fast. He's clinging to his mother. And it is that very concept that the apostle says you need to have toward truth, toward what is right. I think about the prophet Habakkuk with this. As Habakkuk was facing all of this wickedness and a group of people that he was living with who should have been holding fast to what was good, but yet they were holding fast to wicked, as he ends his short written prophecy, he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the field yields no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herds in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation, come what may. No matter what life presents, I'm staying with the Lord. I'm sticking with Him. And the Lord says, when you do that, that's how you're going to show this genuine love. What this means then is that no one, anywhere, at any time, has any difficulty seeing which side I belong to. Sometimes when I'm teaching my government class, I know that I have succeeded when at the end of the semester, the students will say, are you a Democrat or a Republican? Which is it? And I've even had kids leave my room, go to my wife's classroom and say, does he vote for the Democrats or the Republicans? Because what I've tried to do is to be neutral in my presentation. I want to tell you something. We better not ever, ever be like that spiritually. Where someone says, I'm not sure whether he's on the side of good or evil. I can't really tell. Because sometimes I see him doing good things, and sometimes I see him doing bad things, and I just really don't know. No. The Lord says, you abhor what is evil, and you cling to that which is good, and in so doing, you will show your love to fellow man. Many times in a sermon of this nature, this is where we stop the idea and we leave it with some kind of this nebulous feeling about love out there that we really can't grab onto. Let me not do that on this one. In practicality, what does that then mean for us? What it means is that for my fellow man, I am showing him kindness in every way I possibly can. And so what that means is that there is no room for racism in my life. There's no room for prejudice in my life. There's no room for hatefulness in my life. When I am looking toward my fellow man, everything that I am doing for him is being done for his good, and I am doing nothing to him in any way that's going to cause him any harm. In practicality, it also means that I'm generous to my fellow man. So many times we spend our sermons and our classes and we talk about what a local church can do. And that is so good and so right that we do so, because the concept is so messed up in the world. God did not make a local church to be a benevolent agency to the world. You look at the New Testament, and it is just not that. And what wisdom the Lord demonstrates in that regard. Can you imagine if it was our job to go out and to show benevolence to any and everybody around? Our attention would be so diverted, we would not get the gospel message preached in many places. And we would not be able to focus much on the work that really needs to be done. And so God said in that regard, I'm giving a very narrow, limited focus. But that cannot be where the discussion stops. Because while the Lord did not give that to a local church, He did give that to us as individuals. And so I know that I am not going to try to place the local church in a wrong situation by saying, you take care of that, because I've got other things I need to do. Not at all. What I look at and I see is that if I am showing that selfless love toward my fellow man, when I have the opportunity or when I seek the opportunity to help someone in need, I am going to take it, and I'm going to do it sacrificially, presenting myself, as the first part of this chapter says, as a living sacrifice. And in practicality, I let others know about lights shining. So many times when the words personal work are used, people cringe. And I think that's for a number of reasons. I think many times preachers and perhaps others have almost tried to guilt trip congregations into teaching the gospel, and this idea of personal work almost becomes something rather frightening. At other times, it's because we have this terrifying idea that I'm expected to go and knock on all these doors of strangers, and, well, that's a good thing if that's your talent. But for most Christians, it's just simply wanting others to find what we have found. And that may be co-workers, and it may be neighbors, and it may be friends, and it may be whomever. But part of that love is saying to someone, I'd like to tell you about my faith. I'd like to study with you. I'd like for you to see the kind of love that God has shown to me. And in great practicality, what we are doing is we are spreading that love to those of the world, to our fellow man. And so love, in the biblical sense, is far from this foggy notion that it's some kind of word that really can't be defined. No. The Lord has shown us very clearly what it means to love our fellow man. But Paul takes it one step further in verse 10. And I want you to look, if you're still there in Romans chapter 12, to look down to verse 10. And if we were to go around and read various translations of verse 10, we would find very different language being used. You may have something like, show brotherly affection. Because when we come to the first part of verse 10, the word love is there once again, but it's not agape. It's not that selfless love that's being described. In fact, if we were to go back to the original language, what it would say is this, is that when I'm showing love, it's this Philadelphia love. This love for my fellow man in the sense of not this general idea, but the idea rather of a very close, warm family affection. We look at verse 10, and I believe the Apostle Paul has made his comments much more specific. In verse 9, show love to the world. In verse 10, show love to your brethren. Because you see, as lights in the world, we're also lights to one another. And he says in this, I want you to understand that if you look at the kind of relationship that you have with your brethren, the kind of nuance that's being described here is what you would feel toward a very, very close family member. Look at how Paul talks about this in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 8. He says, for God is my witness, how I yearn for you with all the affection of Jesus Christ. That language would actually say, if translated exactly, it would say, I feel for you in my bowels. Now we think about that and we say, boy, that sounds odd. We don't understand that. Here's the interesting thing. The Hebrews believed that the deepest, most affectionate emotions were found deep down inside of you. The more 21st century translation would be, I'm loving you from my gut. I'm loving you from as deep down as I possibly can. And as the apostle talked to the Philippians, what he said to them is, I have a yearning for you, a brotherly affection for you, this Philadelphia kind of love for you, because I believe that you are some of the closest people I have on the face of the earth. We look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. And so as the apostle narrows this down, he's not getting rid of the idea of agape love. We certainly have that for each other. But he's saying there's another facet to this. This is a love that Christians develop that promotes a family bond. And what that then means is that a Christian's relationship with other Christians is far, far more than some cold acquaintance that might be developed. Think for a minute about the closest family member you have. I'm talking about one that you just get along with better than any other. And contrast that with how you would treat a stranger. We've just been talking about that when we treat strangers in a certain way, it's with love, it's with this non-self-serving idea. But that's not how you would treat that close family member. And so the apostle is making a point to us that that's the kind of feelings we should have toward fellow Christians. And he takes that to another level when he says, not only do you have that feeling, but he says, also, I want you to outdo one another in showing honor in these relationships. Can you imagine the kind of local church that would develop if every member tried to outdo every other member in showing honor? You know, the Lord is typically against rivalries. He hardly ever talks about that. But here the apostle says, let this be a friendly rivalry among you. See who can outdo each other in doing good things for one another. Because a church that does that has mastered what the apostle talked about in verse 3. This is a church that has removed pride completely out of its midst. There's no one who's trying to be self-serving. There's no one who's trying to get anything out of it. No. This is a group of people who has killed pride dead away so that nothing stands in the way of that relationship. And really, what that's going to do is to prepare the way for the rest of Romans chapter 12. All of these different commands for lights in the world, we understand, are flowing out of this. But let me do this as we did before. We don't want to leave it at just this kind of foggy notion. In practicality, what does that mean for me? If I am showing this brotherly love, this Philadelphia love for my brethren, what does that then mean for me? Here's what it means. My brethren are not strangers. They're family. In coming weeks, Lord willing, we're going to pick up that idea later on down in chapter 12 of how the apostle says you deal with that. But for now, let's just say this, that when I'm thinking about fellow Christians, those with whom I'm associated, especially in a local work, here are people who I don't have to just wonder about and think, oh, I wonder what they're like. No. These are people we know. These are people who are family. And it means also that I have a very genuine interest concerning their well-being. We think about 1 Corinthians 12, a little bit later down from where we read earlier, where the apostle says, if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. What an amazing thought that we could so devoid ourselves of pride that when something good happens to a brother, we don't internally say, wonder why he got that and I didn't. I wonder why that's happening to him, but nothing good ever happens to me. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing, both personally and congregationally, if that kind of notion was just completely ridded? Whether you're 16 years old or 96 years old, it doesn't matter, that you are looking for the good for your brother, the concern. And that pretty much gets us to our third point. And in practicality, I understand that jealousy and that pride is far removed. That's the kind of light that needs to be shining in a local church. That's the kind of light that needs to be shining in our relationships with our brethren. Because the apostle says, while you show love to everyone, this is a very special kind of love and a very practical kind of love that sees to the needs of your fellow traveler on the way to heaven. And so after going through these things this morning, I just ask all of us to ask ourselves this question: how is my fuel source? When I think about my fellow man, am I marked with a kind of love for him that I'm doing everything I can for his good? When I think about my brethren, I'm doing everything I can for their good. Because when I am well fueled, my light is going to shine brightly. And when my light shines brightly, others are going to see God living through me.